From Maryland to Alaska, New Jersey to Indiana, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the cost of health care is back in the spotlight as Congress wrestles with the expiration of COVID-era Obamacare subsidies. Ed Heiselmeyer of the Heritage Foundation is here with an update. As 2026 approaches, key gubernatorial races are shaping up in Florida and Pennsylvania. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The rising levels of political violence have become a major concern. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine discusses the issue with Sabrina Schaefer of the R Street Institute. And pop music is not as popular as it once was. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College explains why on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Expiring COVID-era healthcare subsidies have exposed the degree to which the Affordable Care Act has made healthcare more unaffordable. To learn more, we turn to Ed Heiselmeyer. Ed is a research fellow in health policy at the Heritage Foundation. Ed, welcome to American Radio Journal. Ed, right now we have a situation with the affordability of healthcare. It has been open enrollment. Healthcare was front and center in the recent federal government partial shutdown. How did we back ourselves into this situation?
Well, the first thing to understand is it's not just confined to the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare, which is what everything's been in the news and the shutdown. I mean, that's just a small slice of it. This is something that's going on throughout the whole system. There's about 15 million people that get subsidies through Obamacare, but there are 160 million or more that are getting their coverage through an employer or a union plan. And that's about half the country. And they're seeing double-digit increases as well. How do we get into it? Well, it's been decades of basically people hiding the costs and masking it and an inability to find out what the actual prices are. And people saying, well, I've got a better deal for you, but you don't know how much of a better deal it is because you don't have the information to compare. And so that's the problem.
And so we have the situation now, Ed, where Democrats in Congress are wanting to extend the temporary subsidies that were put into place in order to deal with COVID 5 years ago. Is really continuing those subsidies going to do anything to help the problem?
Those subsidies really don't make much of a difference. Remember that people on the ACA exchanges with subsidies were already getting heavily subsidized, and as premiums increased, the amount that the enrollee had to pay was basically held constant. What happened with those extra subsidies was they just reduced the amount that the enrollee had to pay temporarily, and now it goes back to what it was in 2020. But the problem has been that the whole design insulated them from the costs, and it actually encouraged insurers and hospitals to just keep passing costs on because the government was going to cover it. So this is a very overblown situation. And, you know, it's interesting because when you go on the exchange and look at that, in some of these states, the state exchange says, you know, you're still going to get a subsidy. It's just maybe not as much as you got last year, but hey, you can still shop for plans. So I don't see this as people actually running around with their hair on fire. But that said, we do have an underlying problem, and this is just one manifestation of it, and that is we keep paying more and more to the providers. Remember, the insurance company is taking in premium dollars on one side, but then paying it out to the doctors and hospitals on the other side, by and large.
So we have the situation here where the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, clearly wasn't affordable. As you've mentioned, there is a larger systemic problem here. So, Ed, let's talk a little bit about solutions. It's a huge problem. President Trump, for one, is proposing that instead of funding insurance companies and insurers, that we should just give money directly to people. Is that a potential solution?
Well, that's one mechanism, and we're in favor of that, because any time you put the dollars in the hands of the patients and consumers, then you're putting the decision-making in their hands. And that's an important condition, because once they've got the dollars, then they have an ownership of, well, what am I spending my money on, and why should I go with you versus somebody else? What's the quality? What's the cost? How does that balance out? So that's an important precondition, and we think that the president's instincts are correct on that. Now, there's a lot of mechanics of how you do it, because we have a kind of balkanized system, so you have to do it differently for different people. But conceptually, he's on the right path. The other thing that we're pointing out is the president also is on the right path with the initiatives of making the prices transparent, letting people know what is being charged and what is being paid and how much the middlemen are making. And we did this in pensions a number of years ago so that people weren't just profiting off of the pensions without the enrollees knowing. And the government has the authority to do that. And so what we're encouraging the Trump administration to do is to go big and bold on forcing hospitals, insurers, third-party administrators, pharmacy benefit managers, all those middlemen to show their homework, to show what the real prices are and who's getting paid by whom, how much. Because every time we find a way to lift that curtain, we find that there's probably 30%+ that could be cut out of the spending that's just going. And we have this very administrative heavy system. So that is something that the administration can do. The other good news is that this is a bipartisan thing in Congress. There is a bill, there's several bills in Congress, but the one that we think is the best is one sponsored by Senator Marshall, a Republican senator from Kansas, and Senator Hickenlooper, a Democrat from Colorado. And that bill would do legislatively what we're suggesting. The industry, meaning the healthcare or medical industry, is not going to like this. Hospitals don't want to show their homework. Insurers don't want to. Certainly the middlemen don't want to. But, and this is important, this movement not only has bipartisan support, but it's getting support from both business and unions who are running these plans. And they're saying, give us the information, we'll go renegotiate the deals for the benefit of our people.
Is there a way to then inject more competition into the system?
Well, that will be a follow-on from this. And what I'm outlining for you are the big strokes, the big brush strokes. But there's lots of other things that you can do to intensify it. So for example, let's take something fairly common like an MRI. Say the physician says you need an MRI. Well, you can go to lots of different places and get an MRI. Do you have any idea what the price is?
Ed, you've written extensively about this at the Heritage Foundation. So tell us a little bit about the Heritage Foundation. Obviously, we can't cover this very complex issue in just a few minutes, but where can folks go to read more if they want to hear in more detail the proposals put forth by the Heritage Foundation?
It's very simple. It's www.heritage.org. We work across all sorts of issues, the defense and foreign policy issues, the economic and social policy, things like healthcare, education, etc. So you can go to the website. There's a tab where you can look at things by issue area and follow and see what we've written on that.
We've been talking with Ed Heiselmeyer, who is a research fellow in health policy at the Heritage Foundation. Ed, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, he keeps an eye on key races around the country, not only U.S. Senate and Congress, but also we have some very interesting gubernatorial races shaping up for next year. Scott, good to have you here.
Thank you, Loman.
Let us begin in the state of Florida. Obviously, Governor Ron DeSantis, very well known, very popular governor, ran for president, all of those sorts of things. He, unfortunately, is term limited, which creates an open seat in the Sunshine State. It appears that Republicans have a front runner. What's the lay of the land in Florida?
Yeah, this is a race that Byron Donalds, a congressman from the Naples area of Florida, Florida 19th Congressional District, he's been in the race just about the entire year. I think he announced in March or so. And the Club for Growth PAC did make an endorsement for him very early on. President Trump has also thrown his support behind Byron. And he's been barnstorming the Sunshine State for several months, raising a lot of money, has already raised over $30 million, and really established himself as a leader there and as a front runner in this race. There's been a lot of questions on whether another big name might be getting in the race, but Governor DeSantis is term limited. He's got a lieutenant governor that's taken a hard look at it. You've got the former Speaker of the House that's also gotten in the race. But in all the polling that comes out, it shows voters are resonating with Byron Donalds and with President Trump's choice there. The endorsement from President Trump is a big thing. One thing that Ron DeSantis did following his election in 2018 was he turned Florida from a toss-up state to a red state. So this is all about the primary. They did a good job of getting rid of these supervisors of elections in Palm Beach and Broward counties, where a lot of that corruption, electoral corruption, had been occurring for almost a generation. We can go all the way back to the Florida recount in 2000 if you need evidence on that one. But I do think that Byron is in a really good shape to not just be the Republican nominee, but to be the next governor of Florida. And Club for Growth is fully behind his candidacy, and we're excited for him.
That is certainly a very interesting race. And another race for governor that has national implications relative to the 2028 presidential contest. In my home state, Pennsylvania, we have Governor Josh Shapiro up for re-election next year, but it may not be a walk in the park for him.
I look at Pennsylvania as one of these states where President Trump did very, very well in 2016 and 2024, and you're a big part of the Rust Belt. You've got a large number of what I would term as the forgotten voter, the people that feel like government doesn't represent them, and they're tired of these politicians that make hollow promises and don't follow through with it. And so when you've got a strong candidate like Josh Shapiro running for re-election, the question is, what Republican can step forward? You and I have talked a little bit about Stacey Garrity. She's been elected statewide already in Pennsylvania and seems to have a coalescing of support around her race from the Republican activists and also the establishment. That's one that the club is watching closely, and we obviously would like to see Shapiro out of there. You've got a divided government in your legislature with a very, very narrow majority, I believe, in your House of Representatives. And so this election in 2026, it's going to have a consequence for what Pennsylvania looks like, also for that 2028 election, when we don't know if it's going to be J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, or another Republican at the top of the ticket. I probably predict it'll be a unity ticket between the two of them. But Pennsylvania, I think, is ground zero for 2028. And that's why the 2026 governor's race is just so important, not just for the people in the Commonwealth, but for everybody across America that cares about freedom.
I will point out that Stacey Garrity has already been endorsed by the Republican State Party of Pennsylvania. An early endorsement usually doesn't occur to January or February. That occurred early. The wild card there is Doug Mastriano, who was the party's candidate 4 years ago, lost in a landslide, still waiting to see what he might do. Scott, now let's go south once again. I'd like to go to Georgia. There is a U.S. Senate race there. We haven't talked about it for quite a while. Tell us what's been going on in the Peach State.
Well, Georgia is an interesting state because it's one of the best pickup opportunities in America. The incumbent that's running for re-election is John Ossoff. He's one of the youngest Democrat senators in the country. But Georgia is a state that Republicans have done well in, and Trump did win there in 2024. You've got a competitive Republican primary. I think that the front runner right now is Mike Collins, a congressman. And then you've also got another member of Congress, Buddy Carter, running. But there's a third candidate named Derek Dooley, the former head football coach at the University of Tennessee, and he obviously had many other jobs in coaching football as well. His father was a Georgia head coach, so the Dooley family has a lot of residual name ID within the state of Georgia. Governor Kemp has thrown his support behind Dooley, but Mike Collins is sort of the MAGA conservative candidate that has, a pretty good brand. His dad was also a member of Congress in the 90s and had run in Georgia. So the Collins family isn't related to Doug Collins, our Secretary of Veteran Affairs, but is still a very well-known family within the state of Georgia and the Peach State. Buddy Carter is probably in second place right now, but as I see the polling, it's pretty clear to me that Collins has got a decent lead. There's room to grow there, and President Trump seems to be watching this race pretty closely. He has not made an endorsement yet, neither has the Club for Growth PACs, but it's one that we're watching because it's a tremendous pickup opportunity for 2026 in the midterm. And we need to grow the Senate majority because we've got a couple of races that I think are toss-ups.
We, of course, will continue to keep an eye on all major developments in these U.S. Senate congressional and gubernatorial races with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, a few words about the club, please.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. You can visit clubforgrowth.org and learn more about the candidates that the Club for Growth PAC has endorsed and plans to be supporting in these 2026 elections.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Political violence is on the rise, and it is setting off alarm bells across the spectrum. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine takes a look at the problem with Sabrina Schaefer of the R Street Institute.
We are certainly not living through the worst period of political violence in American history. I mean, I can think of several others, the Civil War, the American Revolution, a few others that come to mind right away. But that is only so much consolation when we are living through a period where it does seem like political violence and threats of political violence are on the rise from both the right and the left in a way that is spiraling out of control. So this Thanksgiving week, I wanted to take a step back and just think about how we might restore some of the civic institutions, some of the basic decency that underpins so much of the really important stuff in democracy. And that's what my guest today is going to talk about. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Sabrina Schaefer. She is a vice president of public affairs at the R Street Institute, and I think it's her first time here, so we welcome her to the show. Sabrina, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
We've seen this kind of, I think, unfortunate, certainly in rhetoric, but then also in actions. There's just the vibes are not good right now. There's a greater sort of desire to do violence to each other, it feels like, in this country. And I was hoping this Thanksgiving week, maybe we could think back to the founding era. And I mean, obviously, there were high tensions then, too. Political violence has kind of always been with us. Make some sense of this for me. How do we get out of this kind of dark moment that we're in?
You're right. This is the week of Thanksgiving. I'm speaking to you from Massachusetts. I feel like sort of this nice, deep connection to our founding. And I think it is a moment for us to sort of reflect on those founding principles that the nation was established on, you know, equality, popular sovereignty, civic virtue, federalism, limited effective government, as we would say at R Street. But it does feel as though we are living through a troubling moment when we are seeing this rise in political violence. We have seen attacks on lawmakers and judges, cultural figures, private citizens. And I think it does demand our attention and gives us an opportunity to sort of hit pause and think, what's going wrong and what can we learn from the founding? Because as you noted, yes, it was rife with discontent. It was not smooth sailing from the beginning, and I think there's a lot of lessons that we can take away and apply to today.
Yeah, and I think about the fact Thanksgiving was sort of codified as a national holiday after the Civil War, right? It was hearkening back to the period of the Pilgrims and before the founding, but it was, again, in a period of like intense, literal like violence like we've never seen at any other time in this country before. So we've gone through, you know, certainly worse times than what we're seeing right now. But you do have, as you mentioned, there's been some state lawmakers targeted for assassination. Charlie Kirk's assassination obviously stands out. These things have a tendency sometimes to spiral out of hand. And even though we've come through worse periods in the past, that doesn't necessarily make you feel good about where we're at right now.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, it's sort of helpful in the event that we hosted on this topic last week at R Street, we sort of focused in first on what the founding was like and what this period of tremendous, you know, distrust and personal animosity and such was like. And I think one of the things to keep in mind was that the founders, and this is something our guest Joanne Freeman from Yale talked a lot about, was that our founders were really acutely aware of how fragile this new republic was, right? That with the most minor of missteps, this whole experiment could fall apart. And so, you know, they enveloped themselves in the study of antiquity. They were constantly talking about history. They were thinking about how do they navigate this new world. And I think in some respects, 250 years later, we've forgotten just how fragile this is, that this is an experiment, that at no time in history have we had a republic like this last, and that it takes a lot of work and a sort of recommitting ourselves to self-governance. And that's something that I think we're really focused on at R Street, is sort of reminding our followers and people that we're interacting with that this is an opportunity to sort of dig back in and remind ourselves what it really takes to sustain this republic.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that event. I thought it was fantastic. I believe people can find a recording of that at rstreet.org. We'll point people there at the end of the program. We're talking with Sabrina Schaefer. She is a vice president of public affairs for the R Street Institute. They do lots of fine work on a wide variety of topics. Sabrina, I think the point you made there, I just want to underscore that before we let you go here, that this is, look, America is the most successful and most prosperous country in the history of the world. And yet, despite that, it's not as if these things are predestined in any sort of way, right? I mean, getting to the point that we've gotten to has required a lot of work on the part of individuals, and continuing to be where we are and to go further will also require not just the work of big institutions like the federal government itself, but the work of individual Americans.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that came out of our conversations last week was there is a sort of moment of hope when things get really bad. I think it does force people to sort of to stop and to think about things. And so now we have this opportunity to remind ourselves of this. And I think what better time than as we're celebrating our semi-quincentennial and as we're having gathering with family and friends for Thanksgiving, it's a wonderful time to sort of think about the lessons that we can learn from earlier periods in history and to think about the ways we interact with everyone from our local communities to our national conversations, and think about, you know, how can we bring evidence to conversations? How can we bring sort of respect for one another to our conversations? And ultimately, how can we move forward with a stronger country?
Yeah, and of course, political disagreements, look, that's part of what makes America great. That's part of what's always been part of the fabric of the country. But understanding the difference between a political disagreement and the need to do violence to someone else, I think that's something I'm going to be thinking about at Thanksgiving through the holidays. As you mentioned, as we go into next year, it's the 250th anniversary of the country. A great time, I think, for everybody just to stop and think, hey, on an individual level, what can I do, or what can I avoid doing, maybe on social media, or avoid saying, try to move things in a better direction. Sabrina, thanks for taking some time with us. Really fascinating conversation.
Thank you so much. Have a great Thanksgiving with your family.
And happy Thanksgiving to you, too. Sabrina Schaefer, Vice President of Public Affairs at the R Street Institute. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bamian. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Pop music once pervaded the nation's culture, but it is no longer as unifying as it once was. Dr. Paul Kengor, Editor-in-Chief of the American Spectator, talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Dan Flynn, my colleague at the American Spectator, recently wrote a piece noting that pop star Taylor Swift occupies 8 of the top 10 slots on the current Billboard Hot 100. That's astounding. I was certainly struck by that. I'm struck at how one pop artist could so dominate the charts. The reason is less the singer than the times. In my opinion, the heyday for the Billboard music charts was the late 1970s. Captured uniquely by the American Top 40 broadcasts that were delivered on thousands of stations coast to coast by the legendary Casey Kasem. Thanks to SiriusXM's 1970s station, I listen to these rebroadcasts while on the road during long drives, and along with iHeartRadio. But what always strikes me when listening is the stark contrast between pop music then and now. In the late 1970s, a singer would not have had 8 of the top 10 records at one time. No one dominated like that. As to how Taylor Swift today could be so dominant, Dan Flynn rightly notes that the chart's formula differs dramatically from when it started 67 years ago. Today, digital buys and streaming, rather than the heavy emphasis on single sales and radio airplay, determine influence and placement. And many, if not most of these songs today need not be particularly good or memorable. Dan adds, quote, "Dating back decades prior to the start of my life, I can hum or sing one, a few, or all of the songs in any given top 10. More than 5 decades after my birth, I cannot hum a one. Popular music is not as popular as it once was," unquote. Indeed, Dan, it is not. My theory is that the competition for the likes of Taylor Swift today is simply nowhere near what it was at the height of pop music in the late 1970s. In fact, if you're a fan of that era, try this experiment. When you hear a big song from that period, Google it to see whether it hit number one. Oftentimes, it wasn't because it was squeezed out by so many competitors. Consider, for example, one of my favorites for the day, a well-known blonde, like Taylor Swift, long before Taylor Swift, Olivia Newton-John. A bunch of Olivia Newton-John's songs you probably figured hit number one surprisingly didn't. They were blocked by a plethora of other wildly popular tunes. That includes some of her best from the brilliant Grease soundtrack, including Hopelessly Devoted to You, never hit number one. As another example, the beautiful Crystal Gayle had a smash hit with Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue. Would you believe that that song never made number one? How? Well, because Debbie Boone's You Light Up My Life occupied the top spot for 10 weeks in 1977. And if Debbie Boone wasn't keeping an artist from hitting number one, it might be the Bee Gees, which had over a half dozen number one songs in the latter 1970s. Or Donna Summers, the Queen of Disco, who had 4 number ones in 1978 to 79. The other day, I caught Jefferson Starship's Miracles, terrific melody. I wondered how many weeks it was at number one. I looked it up. The answer, it never got higher than number 3. One would think that many of these 70 tunes would be an easy number one today, given the sheer lack of rivals. Now, I know, young people might think that older guys like myself are merely uninformed about today's music. But I would tell them that they had to live through my era. Pop music pervaded everything, from your car to boombox, transistor radio, the portable cassette, and 8-track players you toted around to the park or beach or wherever. Teens flooded record stores and malls and bought albums and 45s. Every kid had a stereo record player in his bedroom. The Osmonds, Jackson 5, The Carpenters, Tony Orlando and Don, Sonny and Cher, Andy Gibb, John Denver had TV shows. The pop music environment today is not as saturated. Youth have many more options for entertainment, especially via video. And frankly, let's be honest, it's surely a good thing that pop music no longer has the same influence. Much of that music and its messages were sappy and silly. So much so that Paul McCartney wrote one of the best songs of the decade under the title Silly Love Songs. But that aside, I think there is no doubting it. Pop music today simply isn't as popular as it once was. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WBBZ-AM in Ponca City, Oklahoma, KMGZ-FM in Lawton, Oklahoma, along with KSDZ-FM in Gordon, Nebraska. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.